Well, good morning and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. Now, this being a conference of the property industry, I expect you'll want to hear me say something about the Australian property market, and indeed I will. I'll come to that a bit later in the speech. First, though, I want to provide some context for that by talking about the financial and economic environment more broadly. In doing so, I'll be making some longer-run observations, as well as drawing on the analysis recently published by the Reserve Bank in our half-yearly financial stability review. I want to begin by noting that the process of recovery from the global financial crisis has been underway for some years. The epicentre of the crisis is usually dated to the collapse of Lehman Brothers in September 2008, and the general recovery that we've seen since then began about 6 months later. On that basis, we've been in a period of aggregate global recovery for about 6.5 years now. In broad outline, this has been a period marked by a return to approximately trend growth in world GDP, though with some variations around that, and with growth currently a bit less than trend at the moment. A widespread, though somewhat variable, progress in balance sheet repair in banking institutions and improved conditions in financial markets. These are all positive developments, and they represent a substantial cumulative improvement since the height of the crisis. That said, though, there are a number of qualifications that I should make to the summary picture that I've just given you. Growth around the world during this period has been uneven geographically. China and other emerging market economies have led the recovery for much of this period. The US has had fairly steady growth, while Europe has tended to lag, though doing a bit better more recently. Significant labour market slack remains in some areas of the global economy, especially in Europe, and the recovery has been marked by periodic bouts of nervousness in financial markets. One general indicator that things are still some way short of normal is the level of global interest rates, which are still at exceptionally low levels to support growth. An obvious question that arises from all this is, why has the recovery from the deep recession of 2008-09 been as drawn out as it has? I suggest there are two important factors at work here. The first factor is that the GFC period involved more than one crisis. It began in the US mortgage market in 2007 and spread through various channels of contagion to banks and financial institutions in other parts of the world, especially in the euro area and the UK. That was the initial crisis, triggered by poor asset quality and excessive leverage. But even as the US was recovering from that, a second crisis was developing in Europe. That was a crisis of confidence in the sustainability of the euro area as a single currency. At different times, a number of the weaker economies in the euro area came under scrutiny as to whether they would be able to meet their obligations, and concerns were particularly focused on Greece in key periods. These episodes led to strains in financial markets and increases in risk pricing, and they weighed heavily on confidence and on the pace of recovery. With the euro area accounting for around a fifth of the global economy, this in turn acted as a significant drag on growth for the world as a whole. So all of that is the first factor, which could be summarised as more than one crisis. The second factor is that, other things equal, recoveries from financial crises typically take longer than recoveries from other types of business cycle event. It takes time to repair balance sheets, time to reduce excessive leverage and to unwind the asset market imbalances that might be left behind by a crisis, and it takes time to reverse the damage to trust and confidence. One important recent study found that the average duration of impact from financial crises across a range of different countries over the past two centuries has been about 4 to 5 years. And since this current episode has been more severe than most, it's not surprising that its after effects have lasted even longer. An exacerbating factor too has been the international dimension. When a financial or a banking crisis occurs in a single economy or in a smallish group of countries, exchange rate depreciation is often part of the market reaction and part of the recovery mechanism. But there's obviously much less scope for that mechanism to work when a crisis affects large parts of the global economy simultaneously. Taken together, I think those factors that I've just summarised go a long way towards explaining the rather drawn-out nature of the global recovery to date, even though, as I said, conditions now are a lot better than they were a few years ago. Policymakers around the world have been responding to this situation on a number of fronts. Interest rates were reduced to near zero or even slightly below zero in many advanced economies to support recovery and to assist in balance sheet repair, and they still remain at those levels. In Europe, significant institutional reforms are being made to strengthen the stability of the euro area. These are aimed at getting banking and crisis management arrangements to function in a more unified way that makes them more robust to shocks in the future. And globally, there's an extensive program of reform underway, for example, in banking and securities regulation, to build resilience in our financial systems. And Australia has been very much a part of that process. A related development in this period is that there's been a renewed interest in more proactive approaches to the management of systemic risk. Partly this just reflected the basic lesson from the GFC itself, which is that financial crises are costly, and hence there's a strong need for better risk management. And in keeping with that, institutional arrangements have been strengthened in a number of jurisdictions to support more proactive risk management by supervisors where that was found to have been lacking. A related point is that in a low interest rate environment, supervisors have seen a need to be particularly vigilant against a build-up of risk in interest-sensitive sectors. A number of them have been taking measures in recent times to respond to these developing risks, often associated with property lending, and I'll have more to say about that later, specifically in the Australian context. To summarise all that and perhaps oversimplify it, the after effects of the GFC on the global economy have meant an extended period of low interest rates, widespread search for yield behaviour by investors in interest-sensitive sectors, including the property sector, and a strengthened focus on risk management by prudential supervisors. That's the global environment that we're in at present. With all of that as background, I want to turn now to our assessment of the evolving risk environment over the past 6 months, and here I draw on some key messages from our recent review. It's useful to take that subject in three parts. First of all, the global risk environment, then how that environment might be affecting Australia, and then thirdly, domestically generated sources of risk. So starting with the global risk environment, as I've already mentioned, much of the attention from a financial stability point of view over recent years has been on Europe. There's been a particular focus on Greece and on potential spillovers from Greece to other parts of the euro area. Those concerns came to a head around the middle of this year. For the time being, at least, they seem to have been allayed by the new bailout package that was agreed at that time. Unlike the earlier phase of the Greek crisis in 2011 and 2012, market spillovers from this latest bout of uncertainty have been quite limited. For example, risk spreads on securities across other parts of Europe remained relatively low through this recent period. This seems at least partly to reflect a greater degree of confidence now in Europe-wide institutions. The European authorities have taken a number of actions to reduce channels of contagion, including increased support from the ECB and ongoing progress in unifying the system of banking regulation. More generally in Europe, the condition of the financial sector has been improving over the recent period in a number of respects. Non-performing loans of European banks, although they're still high, have been falling now for more than a year. Bank profitability has picked up and banks are now better capitalised. And stronger balance sheets have enabled banks in the euro area to start increasing their lending to businesses and households. So overall, while financial conditions in Europe are still some way from a return to normal, they are significantly improved from where they were a few years ago. Now, while financial risks in Europe seem to have lessened recently, attention has shifted to China and other emerging market economies. China has been an important engine of growth in the post-crisis period, but financial stability risks there seem to have been building. The Chinese economic expansion over recent years has been associated with increasing debt, strongly rising asset prices, and apparent overinvestment in some sectors. If growth of the economy were to fall further from its high recent rates, any past excesses might be exposed, because leverage is always harder to manage in a slower growth environment. These risks, of course, are hard to assess. The Chinese authorities have many levers to support stability and growth, given the large role of the state in the economy, a heavily regulated financial system, and the presence of capital account controls. The central government fiscal position is also very strong, though the overall public sector position is less so, given the build-up of debt of local governments and state-owned enterprises. Outside China, some country-specific risks seem to have increased in a number of other emerging market economies, for example, Brazil, Russia, and Turkey. Among the various factors contributing to that in recent times have been falling commodity prices, political instability, and excessive corporate leverage. Equity prices and exchange rates in these economies have fallen quite sharply. Taken together, these developments have contributed to a pickup in volatility in global financial markets over the past 6 months, after a lengthy period when volatility and risk pricing were unusually low. But even so, risk pricing in most markets remains well below the crisis-related peaks of a few years ago. Now that brings me to the second part of the subject, which is how do these international sources of risk affect the Australian financial system? Direct exposures of Australian banks to the risk factors that I've been describing are quite limited. Exposures to the euro area have been scaled back in the wake of the crisis, and they now represent only around 1% of Australian banks' consolidated global assets. Although exposures to the Asian region have been growing quite rapidly over recent years, they're still at a relatively small share of consolidated assets, currently only around 5%. Many of these exposures are shorter term and trade-related factors which should lessen credit and funding risks to the Australian banks. That said, operational and legal risks could be relatively high, particularly given the rapid expansion of these activities in recent times. As a more general observation, Australian banks have increased their resilience over recent years in a number of respects, responding both to market expectations and to regulatory and supervisory actions. Notably, they've raised their capital ratios and they've shifted their funding structures to make them more resilient to financial market disruptions. Of course, none of this guarantees that Australian banks will be immune to international shocks in the future. But it does suggest that the main effects from the risks that I've just been describing are likely to be indirect, working through the impact of factors like commodity prices, trade flows, and confidence on the broader economy. That brings me to the third part of our risk assessment, namely the domestically generated sources of risk. And here our analysis has for some time focused on the buoyancy in parts of the property market and the leverage associated with that. Much of the focus has been on residential property, and I'm going to start with that before turning to the commercial sector, where risks have also been growing. While the housing market hasn't been universally strong around the country, we have been seeing significant strength in the Sydney and Melbourne markets in recent times, with investors playing a large role. To pick out just a few key facts, housing prices in Sydney have increased by 31% over the past 2 years, and they reached an annual rate of increase of almost 20% earlier this year. Melbourne prices were up by 16% over the year to September this year, and the value of loan approvals to investors in New South Wales approximately doubled over the two-year period to mid-2015. As a result of these developments, the household debt ratio has started to edge up again from a level that was already high at around 1.5 times annual income. It's against this background that the Reserve Bank has highlighted the need for prudence and has supported APRA and ASIC in the measures that they've taken to strengthen lending standards. As a general proposition, mortgage lending standards in the post-crisis period have been relatively tight, at least more so than before the crisis. Low-doc loans are rare, genuine savings are required to fund at least part of the deposit, and the application of interest rate buffers in serviceability assessments by lenders has become common. So that's the positive side. Nevertheless, investigations by APRA and ASIC have shown that lending standards were deficient in some important respects. Specifically, APRA found that in some instances, lenders' serviceability assessments were based on over-optimistic judgments about the reliability of borrowers' incomes, or inadequate estimates of borrowers' living standards, living expenses, or that they failed to take into account the possible effects of future interest rate movements on borrowers' existing commitments. ASIC's review of interest-only lending practices made similar findings. They also noted instances where the lender didn't make reasonable inquiries as to whether the loan product was suitable to the borrower's circumstances. Further to those findings, as a result of the additional scrutiny over the past year and substantial data revisions made by the banks, we now know that the level of investor activity in the housing market was in fact higher than previously thought. As you know, APRA announced a number of supervisory measures in December last year to strengthen mortgage lending standards. These measures included expectations that banks shouldn't be increasing their share of higher risk lending, that growth in investor lending shouldn't be materially above 10%, and that appropriate interest rate floors and buffers should be applied in lenders' serviceability assessments. It's going to take some time for the full impact of these measures and of the more recently announced increases in bank lending rates to become apparent. Nonetheless, the indications to date are that the supervisory measures are having a beneficial effect on lending standards and are working to restrain growth in investor finance. There's also some tentative evidence that sentiment may now be turning in the housing markets in the two largest cities. But it's much too early to be definitive about that. What we can say is that the risks in that sector are now being more prudently managed than they were a year or so ago. The second main area of risk focus domestically is in commercial property. Historically, this has been a common source of financial instability, both here and abroad. During the height of the GFC, Australian banks remained in comparatively good shape, but they did suffer a noticeable deterioration in asset performance, with the aggregate non-performance rate rising to just under 2% of loans. A significant part of that deterioration was in commercial property lending. Impaired commercial property exposures accounted for around 30% of Australian banks' non-performing domestic assets at that time. After the post-crisis downturn, the commercial property sector is again experiencing strong investor demand, and bank lending to the sector is increasing. And there are a number of signs now of increasing risk. Trends in commercial property prices and rents have been diverging over the past few years, with prices continuing to rise while rents have been flat to down. As a result, yields have declined, and at the same time, vacancy rates have been increasing. As in the housing market, conditions haven't been uniform across the country, and they've been noticeably firmer in Sydney and Melbourne than in other centres. But in aggregate, the major categories of commercial property have all seen downward pressure on yields over recent years. Strong demand from foreign buyers has contributed to this, reflecting the global environment of low interest rates and the search for yield that I talked about earlier. The risks appear manageable at this stage, but they underscore the need for sound lending practices and for appropriate prudence by investors. I want to conclude now with just a few comments about the financial stability role of the Reserve Bank. The bank has a long-standing mandate for financial stability, affirmed, for example, as part of the Wallace reforms in 1998. In the post-Wallace world, this function of the bank is not primarily a regulatory one. The bank does have some regulatory powers in some areas relating to financial stability, notably in its oversight of payment systems and financial market infrastructures. But the financial stability function goes well beyond that to the Reserve Bank's wider role in the financial system. It includes the bank's role as liquidity manager for the system and as provider and operator of core payments infrastructure. It also includes coordination with the other regulators. At a formal level, this is done through the bank's role in chairing the Council of Financial Regulators, but there are numerous less formal channels for coordination and for sharing information and analysis. These arrangements were reviewed and supported most recently in the Murray Inquiry. One important component of our financial stability work is the provision of timely risk analysis to help inform the policy debate and also to help inform the decisions of lenders and investors. I've given you a summary today of our most recent analysis, and I hope you'll find that helpful in forming your own investment decisions. With that, thank you for your attention, and I hope you have a successful conference.
So now would be the chance to ask Malcolm questions. Does anyone have any questions? And if so, can you come up to the microphones in the aisles and ask away? Any questions? There we go.
Malcolm, g'day. A question for you on the dealing with the banks, how they temper their profit motive and their shareholder value versus the regulatory guidelines that you ask or talk to them about. That would be question one. The second question is, China recently has started an Asian investment development bank, and I understand that the Reserve Bank, among others, has been involved in assisting them with some financial regulatory assistance. Perhaps you could comment on those two things.
Okay, thank you. If you don't mind, I think I might just stick to the first one of those questions, because the second one is really from a part of the bank that I don't have oversight of. But let's talk about the banks and their profits and costs and so on. It's been in the news a lot in the last few days and weeks. I think the first thing that I want to say is that I'm not here to defend the banks. I don't see that as my role. It's up to the banks to defend their own actions. What the regulators want is safe banks, and they've taken actions. Principally, APRA has taken actions to require the banks to do things that will make them safer, including raising capital. And it was always recognised that that particular regulatory action would have a cost component to it. The Murray report recommended actions on this front and recognised that there would be some increased cost on that. Now, the Reserve Bank Governor has been out over the yesterday talking about some of the numbers on that. The figure that Murray quoted was that a percentage point increase in capital for the banks would add about 10 basis points to banks' costs. But to convert that into what banks should be doing on their own interest rates, you have to make a whole lot of different assumptions about how much cost recovery they need to make of that, how much should be borne by shareholders, how much by customers, and should you attribute all of that cost just to the mortgage lending book, or should it be spread more widely? I think if the banks were here trying to defend the way they came up with those numbers, they would give you some kind of a formula for how they've done that. But it does seem as though the string of calculations that you have to make to get the sort of increases we've seen do rely on a number of assumptions that tend to steer you towards the upper end of the range. But it's really up to the banks to themselves defend the interest rate changes that they've made.
Any other questions?
With the Basel recommendations coming out in the next little while, I think I heard that you're on this committee, I guess we can presume that we're going to have another round of interest rate or margin changes by the banks. How, from an Australian perspective, can we see that the ranking of those recommendations over and above the Murray recommendations for what he saw as a safe return or capital adequacy? Is it going to just override that from an Australian perspective?
Okay, well, I think I could start by saying we need to set bank regulations that are in our own interests in this country. So it's not a case of being automatically dictated to by some foreign committee. But that said, the Basel Committee does set global standards for banks, and our banks need to be able to operate in global markets in order to be able to function efficiently. So it is actually in our interests to at least take the Basel standards into account and to do our best to implement them here in a way that best suits us. So I think APRA is very well aware of those tensions that you raised in your question, and they work very hard at getting a good balance on that. And on Murray, the Murray report does say some things that are relevant to this question as well. The Murray report concluded that it's in the interest of Australian banks to be unquestionably strong and to be seen to be unquestionably strong in a global context. And I think that does support the need for APRA to adhere fairly closely to the Basel standards. And in some cases, there may even be a case for being tougher than the Basel standards. And in some cases in the past, APRA has done that, and that approach has actually served us well and given us better financial stability outcomes than in other countries.
Superannuation, Malcolm. It's contentious at the minute, obviously the politics of it, but talking today, you've mentioned the Australian Council of Financial Regulators, and I wanted to understand what the bank's role was in understanding the implications of superannuation and whether it has any effect or discussions with, say, APRA or ASIC and its involvement, you know, going forward with what they plan to do about it. I don't know what you can comment on that.
Okay, well, the Reserve Bank itself doesn't have a strong role in superannuation, but you referred to the Council of Financial Regulators, which is the coordinating body for the four main regulatory authorities in Australia, and the Reserve Bank chairs that, and that serves as a body for coordinating regulatory actions where that's needed, or for making recommendations to the government where that's needed. The Council did discuss superannuation issues in the context of the Murray inquiry. I think the only general comment I'd make on our particular perspective on that is that we support the sorts of things that Murray recommended to make super more efficient, because it is a very big vehicle for savings in Australia, and it's important that that operate as efficiently as possible.
Malcolm, does the Reserve Bank have a current view on raising the GST?
I don't think I could give you a view on that one. When I'm asked about these sorts of things, the answer I usually give is we want an efficient economy, and the best contribution that we can make to that is good monetary policy and well-regulated financial institutions and an efficient financial sector. We're working hard on all of those things. It's good that the government is talking about these wider issues and how we can get maximum efficiency in tax and in other areas, but it's not something where we would feel we want to give public advice on that.